How did it happen? A department store bear ending up at the local zoo? And which community welcomed African American refugees after the 1937 flood in Evansville? I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with historian and newspaper columnist Brian Spangle. His new book is Hidden History of Vincennes and Knox County. Brian shares the saga of Brunel the Bear, who escaped the butcher twice to find a home at Mesker Park Zoo, and other little-known stories, including how the Knox County community sheltered flood victims along the Ohio River. His book is a collection of columns that appeared in the Vincennes Sun commercial. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. One of the vivid memories of my childhood was taking the train with my fellow Cub Scouts from Evansville to Vincennes. We brought our sack lunches with us and spent a whirlwind day visiting the George Rogers Clark National Memorial, Grouseland, the home of future President William Henry Harrison, and checking out the centuries-old gravestones outside the old cathedral. And by the way, Vincennes is also the hometown of my parents and grandparents. My guest is a Knox County native who shares my passion for history. Brian Spangle worked at the Knox County Public Library for 30 years and has written a column on the community's rich history for the Vincennes Sun commercial since 1999. He's published his first collection of those columns in the book Vincennes History You Don't Know. Now his new book is out, Hidden History of Vincennes and Knox County. So Brian Spangle, welcome to 2 Main Street. You have some great stories in this book and a lot of research involved.
Sure was. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here. Yes, a lot of research involved. I think the average person, when they read one of my columns, have no idea how much research goes into it. Some people ask me how long it takes, and I'm never able to give them an answer because it's different for every column. But sometimes almost every paragraph is a different source to be able to construct the story and put it together.
Now, let's start with some of the stories in the book. And the events in late January of 1937, of course, that's the year of the great flood along the Ohio River, and the city of Vincennes took in some refugees from Evansville. And who were these refugees, Brian?
Well, anyone that knows Evansville history will know that 1937 was the major flood of the Ohio River, and the martial law was declared in Evansville. Part of the city was flooded, so they had to bus some people out of the city. And Vincennes agreed to take in some flood refugees. They were all African Americans, about 160 of them, and they came by bus into Vincennes. They were about 9 hours late because one of the buses broke down. Several of the other buses had to take alternate routes because of the floodwaters. So people in Vincennes were concerned that they hadn't arrived. Finally arrived. It was men, women, and children, even an infant, cold and hungry after their long trip. Of course, Vincennes people were sympathetic to flood refugees because Vincennes had many floods of their own and were very subject to floods. So they arrived in Vincennes. First, they were divided and taken to other locations, but then they were all put together at the old Union Depot Hotel, one of the major buildings in Vincennes, which was vacant at that time and about to be torn down. So it was the perfect location for the flood refugees. Got good food, entertainment, pitched in with chores, stayed for a couple of weeks.
Now, was the Red Cross involved in this?
The Red Cross was involved somewhat, yes. There was a Red Cross nurse there. Only one of the refugees was sick. One was transported to Good Samaritan Hospital. Vincennes didn't have severe flooding that year. They had some flooding in the north end of Vincennes, but Knox County had severe flooding down in what they call the neck of Knox County, where the Wabash River and the White River converge. That's what we call the neck. There was a little community called Orville there, and they had such severe flooding that people were stranded in the school and had to take refuge in certain buildings, and people had to go in by boat to take care of them. That's when I started researching the 37 flood and came on to the story about the Evansville flood refugees that year, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, another story that I found very interesting, the saga of Brunel the Bear, and this saga actually ends in Evansville at Mesker Park Zoo.
It sure does. That's one of my favorite stories. It started in 1919. A man named William Farrell, who had a big department store on the corner of 1st and Main Street in Vincennes, bought a bear named Bruno, a black bear, a former circus bear. And his plan was to butcher the bear. He already had the meat and the hide sold. There was such a public outcry in Vincennes against this, especially among women and children, that he relented and let Bruno live in a cage outside his store. Probably not a happy life for the bear, but at least his life had been spared. He actually became a great asset to the store because people who came to Vincennes walked downtown just to see him, and children fed him candy. But then his fate hung in the balance again. In January 1923, the store burned, and someone had the foresight to open Bruno's cage and let him out. The store was completely destroyed. He was coaxed back to his cage, but then a man who owned Charles O'Donnell, who owned a meat market, purchased him. So there you think, his life might be in the balance again. But he donated him to the Harmony Society, a local club, and they had a small zoo in Harmony Park, just on the east edge of Vincennes. So Bruno lived in Harmony Park throughout the 1920s. There were other animals there, like deer and maybe chickens. They had monkeys also. They actually had monkeys. So Bruno lived there, and another bear joined him, a female bear named Josephine. I don't know her story, but there were two bears. They're a big attraction, you might imagine. The Depression arrives, 1931. The Harmony Society no longer has the money to maintain the zoo, so they have to disperse the animals. And it took me a while to find out what had actually happened to Bruno. I had to go to the Harmony Society and actually look at their minutes. They have excellent minutes going all the way back, and I found that Mesker Park Zoo took Bruno. So he ended up in Evansville. And I'd like to know when he died, but I don't have that part of the story. But I got the end of the story before I published it.
Okay, we go from Bruno the bear to a little more unsavory story. A murder at the Savoy Hotel in Vincennes. Let's go all the way back to 1912. Now, at the time, the Vincennes Sun, I guess it was called then, not the Sun Commercial.
There was a Sun and a Commercial.
Oh, there were two? Okay, competing papers. Were they afternoon and morning papers?
Yeah, and then they merged in 1931, and that's how we got the Sun Commercial.
Okay, there we go. So it was the Vincennes Sun. Now, he called this murder a story of unrequited love, destruction, jealousy, and insanity. Murder at the Savoy Hotel. Sounds salacious.
It was. I have found, and this shouldn't be too surprising, that whenever I write about any kind of crime, I get more feedback from people than anything else, because that's what people are interested in. Just look at how many crime procedurals are on television. So this took place in 1912, and there was a young woman named Helen May. She was only 17 years old. She performed at the Grand Opera House. She and her mother were sitting at the Savoy Cafe, which was on 2nd Street, waiting for a carriage that would take them to the depot to take their train to the next location. And she had had a relationship with a man named Thomas Harry Davies, who was 36, quite a bit older than her. He had followed her to Vincennes. She had spurned him, so it was unrequited love. And he had come to Vincennes with the intention of killing her. So he walked into the cafe and shot her 4 times, killed her. He was then arrested, taken to jail, and he hanged himself later that night. So it was murder and suicide. So that was the salacious story from 1912.
And this guy was a wrestler or something?
He was a wrestler, yes. One of the little tidbits about that was that Helen May had a little white poodle with her named Midge, and the poodle was at the cafe also. And in all the
commotion.
Yeah, the commotion. He escaped and wandered the streets for several days, but he was finally found and sent back to her mother.
Okay.
I think they came from Missouri, I believe.
Now, my guest is Brian Spangle. He's the author of the new book, Hidden History of Vincennes in Knox County. Now, Brian, there was a time when Major League Baseball teams actually toured the country and played some hometown clubs, and the St. Louis Cardinals actually came to Knox County in 1921. And who did the Cardinals play?
They played a local team called the Bicknell Braves from the town of Bicknell. It wasn't until I started doing my research, I think, that I was even aware that these major league teams came and played in cities that size. But they did when they were in the off season or when they were traveling, to other games. They were coming from New York to St. Louis.
It's extra income.
Mm-hmm, that's right. They charged $1,000 to play the local team, the Braves. So July 25th, 1921, the game was all set. Fortunately, the organizers of the game had taken out an insurance policy in case of rain, since they had to pay them $1,000. They paid $140 for an insurance policy. And it rained that day.
You know, everyone was looking, well spent.
Everyone was looking to the skies, and the Cardinals arrived, but they weren't able to play the game. So, yeah, money very well spent. So the game was rescheduled for September. September 7th, the Cardinals arrived again, and the game was on. Sunny, beautiful day. 2,000 to 3,000 people turned out. They were able to play the game, and the Bicknell Braves, which was a very good team, defeated the Cardinals by a score of 9-6. And some people speculated that the Cardinals had let them win, but I don't think that's really true. More people thought that they didn't realize what a tough team they were playing, and they started off easy and then were just never able to catch up. But they played, part of the contract called for them to have all of their star players, including future Hall of Famer Rogers Hornsby. So he was in Bicknell. Pretty big deal for Bicknell. That's 100 years ago this year.
I'm sure that was a big crowd for that game.
Huh? It certainly was. Although Bicknell had a larger population at that time, the town of Bicknell was surrounded by coal mines and had a much larger population in 1921 than it does today.
Now, another column that caught my eye was the prevalence of fox drives. That's when men, women, and children got involved in what was kind of a social event to curb the fox population. Yeah. That's bizarre.
That's not a column for animal lovers. And in fact, that was going to go into my previous book, and then the publisher didn't like it because there's a lot of cruelty involved there. But they did have big fox drives. The ones I wrote about were in the 1920s. It was usually a couple of townships might join together, and there might be 1,500 or 2,000 people.
Really?
And they just made a big circle and converged, you know, beating pans and trying to round up the foxes, because to them, foxes was a big menace then, catching chickens and even small pigs, it was said. So they would do that on specific days in the wintertime, of course, when there were no crops out. Thousands of people, they would converge on the foxes and then club the foxes to death, along with any rabbits that might have gotten in the roundup. And they did make it a social occasion, like women from a church would serve a meal, and then they auctioned the foxes off to raise a little money. So that was a big event. And I remember asking my dad, telling me one time that he's deceased now, but would be in his 90s now, that he remembers participating in those out in the country.
So, okay. Now we have a checkers champion that came to town, a checkers champion named Newell Banks. And I was surprised to learn that people paid admission to watch a checkers champ play.
I'm sure most people have never heard of the name Newell Banks, unless they're a real checkers or chess aficionado. But checkers was really popular in the 1920s, and he traveled around. He was the best checker player in the United States. Traveled around giving exhibitions and playing local players, and checkers had become very popular in Vincennes. It was played at the YMCA. So he came. Let's see, what year was it? It was in the 1920s. Played some local men. One of the really fascinating things, the thing that fascinated me the most about that, is that he not only played games simultaneously, could play several games of checkers or chess simultaneously, but he could play checkers blindfolded. And I had to figure out, how do you play checkers blindfolded? Well, the individual was blindfolded. They never touched the checkers, but they spoke the moves. Someone else moved the pieces, and they had to remember where the pieces were. And what's even more fascinating is he could play more than one game of checkers blindfolded simultaneously. So I think that was really fascinating.
Newell Banks, folks. Mm-hmm. Now, from checkers, we go to miniature golf, which I understand I didn't know it was this popular back in the 1920s.
Yeah, in the 20s, miniature golf started. It became really popular in Vincennes in the 1930s. By 1930, there were 4 miniature golf courses in Vincennes. The piece I wrote about was about Fort Sackville course, which was downtown, a really elaborate golf course. They had tourneys. They kept track of people who had the best games, and it was just an enormously popular pastime at that, kind of a fad, really. It was really a big fad at that time, which eventually, as all fads do, it mm-hmm. went to the wayside.
Now, was this a family event?
It was a family event. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyone could play. They had the course record. The man who shot the record at the Fort Sackville had a score of 34, so he had a pretty good record. And the women champion had a score of 40. So
there you go.
18 holes. 38 was considered par.
That's impressive. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about Brian Spangle's career at the Knox County Public Library. What treasures lie inside? We'll also continue to check out the hidden history of Vincennes in Knox County, including visits from prominent entertainers and politicians. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Brian Spangle, whose new book is Hidden History of Vincennes in Knox County, a collection of his columns in the Vincennes Sun Commercial newspaper, which, by the way, is the oldest newspaper in the state. Is that Brian?
1804 with the Indiana Gazette. Elihu Stout published the Indiana Gazette in 1804, and then his shop burned, and he started again and published the Western Sun in 1807. That's the date that most people are aware of, and the name of the newspaper that most people are aware of is the Western Sun.
And then we learned that it was the Sun and then another paper, and they merged.
There were a lot of newspapers in Vincennes in the 19th century, more than I could even name, all kinds of small newspapers. By the time the 20th century got here, we had the Sun, the Commercial, and a newspaper called the Post, which lasted until the 1930s. But in 31, the Sun and the Commercial merged, and that's how we have today's Sun Commercial. So they're a descendant of the first newspaper in the Indiana Territory.
Now, you're a Knox County native. Where did you grow up in Knox County, Brian?
I'm originally from the northern part of the county, just north of Edwardsport. I grew up on a farm there, went to North Knox High School, then went to Vincennes University, and went to Indiana State University and got my master's in history.
Now, how did you get this library job?
Well, I went put my application in. I've been at the library since 1986, put my application in and got a call. I wouldn't have believed it if they told me I'd be there for 30 years, but I was. I didn't start off in the historical collection, but I moved to that slowly. Anyone who visited the Vincennes Library back in those years would be very familiar with the term the cage, and that's where our historical collection was. It was in a little cage, iron bars on the main floor. People couldn't actually go in and pick up a book. They had to, you know, write down the book they wanted, and a staff member had to get it for them. Then in 1992, they moved down to the lower level and expanded the collection, and people were actually able to go and browse and have open access. Then 10 years later, in 2002, the library acquired the old Brockman Funeral Home directly across Hart Street, and that's where they established their historical collection and actually merged several collections there to have one of the best genealogy local history collections around, 3 floors of material.
Now, these documents, how far do they go back?
Knox County was formed in 1790, and we have original records that go back to 1790. One fortunate thing is the library's always had a very good relationship with the county, and they actually let us take early Knox County records. So the thing that's really unusual about our library is that we have Knox County records dating back to 1790. We've got the probate records and deeds, which begin in 1814, civil and criminal records from the 1790s. So most of the early Knox County records are actually at the library rather than people having to go to the courthouse for them.
Any of the records, I know it was a French community originally.
Originally French, after the French and Indian War, where the French military left, but French families stayed. So French was actually the dominant nationality till about 1900 or 1800. Mm-hmm. Till 1800.
So some of these documents in French?
Some of them are in French, mm-hmm. And we have some pretty unique signatures. Everyone's familiar with Francis Vigo, who helped finance George Rogers Clark's attempt to take Fort Sackville. And we have a lot of Francis Vigo signatures in our documents. Well, we have the original, what they call the slave register, when people, that dates from the early 1800s, when, you know, slavery was prohibited in the Northwest Territory, and but people got around that by indenturing their slaves. People call it the slave register, but it's more of a register of indentures, and we have that original book, so I think that's pretty unique.
Oh, yes.
They would indenture them for, you know, 20, 30 years, which was basically slavery. So we've done a lot of preservation work with the original records that we received from the courthouse. If anyone, any genealogist knows this, but anyone that's familiar with the really early paper records, court records in particular, know that they, when they stored them, they quarter folded them. They quarter folded them and put them in boxes. Sometimes they were tied with ribbon. So it's been a, we've received several grants, and it's been an enormous project to unfold those, clean them, flatten them, and put them in the acid-free folders and the Hollinger boxes. So we have hundreds and hundreds of boxes that we've where we've stored documents archivally that were originally soiled and in file drawers. There are many more to do, but we have a big part of the collection stored that way.
Have you digitized?
Some of them have been digitized. Some of the early civil and criminal records have been digitized. Some of the early probates have been digitized. And our newspapers are actually digitized, mm-hmm. so people can search our newspapers from our website.
Now, my guest is Brian Spangl. He's the author of Hidden History of Vincennes in Knox County. And you are a member and past president of the Vincennes Historical and Antiquarian Society mm-hmm. and the Northwest Territory Genealogical Society. And you currently serve on the Vincennes Board of Cemetery Regents, so you're pretty active in all these organizations. And I'm just wondering, you were talking about genealogy. Have you been able to research your genealogy?
I have researched my genealogy, specifically my dad's side, which goes back to Germany. And they came in the 1840s through New Orleans, as many of the Germans did at that time.
So when did they settle in Knox County?
1846.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Pretty early.
So what were their occupations?
All farmers all the way back.
Mm-hmm. Now, and you said you grew up on a farm.
I did, yep. Grew up on a farm, original farm that had been in the family all those years.
So what were the crops?
Corn, soybeans, mm-hmm. wheat.
Livestock?
White hogs, mostly.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there we go. Now, you received the Hubert Hawkins History Award from the Indiana Historical Society, and you received national recognition from the DAR for historic preservation.
That would be the work that we've done with the county records, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, that big task that's been undertaken to better preserve the county records.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's get back to some of this hidden history of Vincennes in Knox County. And one of your favorite stories involves the Abernathy brothers, Lewis and Temple. And they were adventurous lads, weren't they?
That's one of my favorite stories as well. Lewis, who was known as Bud, and Temple, known as Temp, were two young boys, ages 10 and 6, who in 1910 decided to ride their cow ponies across the country from Oklahoma. Their father had known Theodore Roosevelt, former president, and Roosevelt was coming back from his big African safari and tour of Europe, and they wanted to go to New York to meet him. So they just rode their ponies across the country, which I suppose that'd be child abuse today, but you could do that back then. And they stopped in communities along the way. They stopped in Vincennes in May of 1910, stayed overnight, stayed at the Grand Hotel, went on their way, met Roosevelt, actually bought a car, shipped their horses back on the railroad, bought a car, and drove back home. But they took did all kinds of other adventurous trips like that. The interesting part is how I came about finding out about the Abernathy boys. I had really never heard of them, and I was working at my desk at the library one day. I still remember it. It was a Saturday morning, and this couple came in getting close to lunchtime, and that's what they were researching, the Abernathy boys. They were following their route across country, and they were looking at local newspapers to see what had been written about them. And I can remember thinking, there won't be anything about that in the papers. But we looked, and all three papers that were publishing at that time had written up the Abernathy boys being in Vincennes. So it gave a lot of neat detail about them, and they were happy to get the information. But that's how, you know, sometimes you come up with a story, you know, just through a patron. That's happened many times.
Whatever happened to the Abernathy boys when they grew up?
Well, most people are not familiar with them, as I wasn't, but there's actually a statue to them in Frederick, Oklahoma, where they were from. One of the wives wrote a book about them. They had very successful lives, lived long lives. One became a lawyer, one became an oil man. Mm-hmm. One died in 1979 and one in 1986. But there's a book called Bud and Me, The True Adventures of the Abernathy Boys that one of the wives wrote.
Mm-hmm. Now, other interesting visitors to Knox County include national politicians and celebrities. And Buffalo Bill Cody brought his show, his big Wild West show, to Knox County.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in famous people that came to visit Vincennes, be they entertainers or presidents or presidential candidates. And probably the most famous person in the United States, arguably, at the turn of the 20th century was Buffalo Bill, who brought his Wild West shows all across the country. And he actually came to Vincennes in October of 1898. Wild West show performed, had their street parade where he rode, all the shows were preceded by a street parade, rode through the city. What was really amazing to me is how many people turned out for his show. The population of Vincennes in 1900 was only a little over 10,000. And it said that 16,000 people came to his afternoon show and 8,000 that night. So Vincennes was bursting at the seams with all the people who came to see Buffalo Bill. I was also really interested in the logistics of how they traveled. They had it down to an art form. They even unpacked their own seating. You know, where did all those people sit? They had their own seating that they brought on the train with them. And, of course, the famous Annie Oakley was there, and, mm-hmm. and they traveled with bison. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was quite a show.
I bet it was. Now, another entertainer of sorts, a burlesque star, the infamous Sally Rand. Did she cause a stir when she performed in Vincennes?
A little bit of a stir. A very controversial performer, but very famous by the 1930s. She had started out she did silent movies and in burlesque and even was an acrobat. But she really made her claim to fame in 1933 when she performed at the Chicago World's Fair, and she debuted her famous fan dance, where she danced with ostrich feathers with the appearance that she was not wearing anything, and then also did that similar dance with behind a large ball, 5-foot balloon, because when she did a performance outside, the feathers blew, so that helped her perform outside. And one interesting little bit of information, it said that Cecil B. DeMille gave her her name when he walked by a Rand McNally Atlas, and that's how Sally Rand got her name. But she performed in Vincennes on June 8th, 1935, at the Pantheon Theater, the big venue for performances on Main Street. A lot of criticism from people. A lot of people didn't think she should have been there. The Pantheon management had to, you know, put information in the paper that said, you know, a lot of people are criticizing something, a show that they've never even seen. But she did perform. There were a lot of other performers there. I read that there were still tickets available the day of the show. The reserved seats were 75 cents. So I don't know if it was a full house, but she had a sizable audience that enjoyed her performance, probably mostly men.
I bet. Okay, now there's a gentleman, and his name was Gentleman Jim. Mm-hmm. And he was a famous boxer, and he stopped by.
That's an interesting story as well. March 8th, 1928, 61-year-old Jim Corbett, former heavyweight champion of the world, came to Vincennes. It was after midnight, and his train brought him to Vincennes, and he walked to the ticket office to find a connecting train for his next stop. It just so happened that the ticket agent recognized him. It was in the 1890s when he won his title, so he was past being a boxer, but he was still one of the most famous men around. So, and I think if the ticket agent hadn't have recognized him, no one would have ever known that Gentleman Jim was in Vincennes. But he called a number of people to come, and after midnight they came to the depot while he was waiting for his connecting train and talked to him. And
one of the autographs, I'm sure.
I'm sure, yeah. And one of the people who came was the sports writer for the commercial. So, of course, it ended up in the paper the next day that he had made that little stop there. So I thought that was interesting.
And I think you wrote in your column, too, he was in pretty good shape.
He was in very good shape. He was at his same weight, I think, which was 190 pounds, same weight he'd been in his fighting days at the age of 61.
Gentleman Jim. Now, a famous Vincennes native is not part of the hidden history of the community, but, of course, we can't avoid talking about comedian Red Skelton, of course, a native of Vincennes, and there's probably a lot of stories about Red's early years in Knox County.
There are, and I've actually written a couple of columns about Red. I wrote about, they don't appear in either of the books, but I read about when he came back to Vincennes in 1939, that was right after he'd made it big, and he came back to Vincennes many times, and of course his big visit was 1963 when the Red Skelton Bridge over the Wabash was was named for him. But it is interesting to see if his name turns up in some of the early papers, and it actually does. There was, in the 1920s, the Catholic Church had an event called the Gibault Circus, where the kids dressed up and they did a parade. They dressed up as animals and did the circus routine. And I was researching that and wrote about it one time, and it mentioned that he was 14 years old at the time, I think it was 1928, that he fainted, a child named Red Skelton fainted at the corner of 4th and Main, and the circus wagon came and picked him up and took him to the circus grounds, all part of the big show. But there were people in Vincennes that remembered him as a child, and you know, everyone would say he was what you would expect, the class clown, just what you would expect.
And he ran away and really joined the circus, I understand.
Mm-hmm, he did.
It's a classic story.
And look where he ended up.
Yeah,
worldwide fame.
Now, of course, if anybody wants to learn more about Red Skelton, there's a museum at Vincennes University.
Red Skelton American Museum of Comedy and Red Skelton Performing Arts Center is there. And then across from the Performing Arts Center, you can still see Red Skelton's home. It's no one cannot go in it, but it has a historical marker, and people can still see Red Skelton's home.
Also, some other comedians to talk about. Abbott and Costello came to Vincennes. Of course, part of the bond drives, and entertainers would go all across the country during World War II.
Mm-hmm. During World War II, it was important for celebrities to sell war bonds, and Abbott and Costello, the famous comedy duo, came to Vincennes in August 1942. They were to entertain at a joint meeting between the Kiwanis and the Rotary, held at one of the cafes. It didn't seat very many people, so only about 140 people were able to see them. Again, came to sell war bonds. They were late in arriving. Finally got there. They were so late in arriving, so off schedule that they couldn't sell war bonds while they were there. But they did do their famous "Who's on First" routine for the audience. So created quite a stir when Abbott and Costello came.
And politicians, they're always on the road during elections. Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to Vincennes in 1920. This is at the Knox County Courthouse. He was a candidate for vice president then.
I think most people are aware, at least most people in Vincennes are aware, that Franklin Roosevelt came in 1936 to dedicate the George Rogers Clark Memorial, probably the biggest day in the history of Vincennes, arguably. But he also came in 1920. In October of 1920, he was on the vice presidential ticket with Ohio Governor James Cox. He drove into town. They were doing the towns along the way. He came from Sullivan, and I think he was headed to Evansville. But with Eleanor and his little entourage just in a car, and did a speech on the 8th Street side of the Knox County Courthouse, walked across the lawn and onto the podium because he wouldn't be stricken with polio until the next year, so he was still able to walk at that time. Did his speech. They said about 1,200 people turned out. One thing that I'm always cognizant of when I write anything about politics is to look in both of the papers, the Democrat and the Republican papers, because you get such a different view by looking at the partisan newspapers. And of course, the Democrat Sun said he was a wonderful speaker and talked about the big crowd that turned out. And the Commercial, which was the Republican leaning paper, said there might have been 1,200 people there, but a lot of them were curious Republicans, and they always had something negative to say. It gets a lot worse than that with some of the politicians that came. But I always look at all of the newspapers for any story that I do, but you especially have to do that with something political.
Well, let's go back to when he came for the George Rogers Clark National Memorial, and you said that might have been one of the biggest stories in the community in maybe the 20th century. How many people showed up for that?
I actually have that story in my first book. I decided to include that story. The numbers vary. I don't know what numbers you would believe, but they vary up to 100,000. And there's a panoramic photo of the crowd in front of the memorial that day, and it is completely full from one end to the other. Interesting thing is he was only in the city for an hour. He got off the train. He and Eleanor drove to the memorial. They drove him up. They had a special ramp. Gave his speech and left. And it was a really hot day. There are people that remember being there and how hot it was. They said as soon as his speech was over, the crowd just completely dispersed.
My guest is Brian Spangle, author of the newly published Hidden History of Vincennes in Knox County. And this is not the first collection of those Vincennes Sun commercial columns. And now in 2015, Vincennes History You Didn't Know. Now, in that book, did you uncover any real surprises in your research in that book?
There are a lot of pieces in that book that would fit perfectly in the Hidden History book, because, again, they're stories that a lot of people wouldn't know. Not all of them, but there are a few. And I also want to credit the Knox County Public Library for helping with the publication of that book. But there are a lot of them. The outlaw Emmett Dalton was in Vincennes in 1915, the bank robber Emmett Dalton. He was out of prison and had received a pardon. He was traveling around and lecturing at movie theaters. There's a really funny quote that I put in the book about how he said, it's a lot better to be walking down the street without worrying about someone shooting at you all the time. So Emmett Dalton was in Vincennes. There's a really good piece that I call Saving Rex. It's about Rex the Pony. And I mentioned that the city of Bicknell had a lot of coal mines around that area. That was really the lifeblood of Bicknell back then. But they worked mules in the mines. And in this instance, they had a pony named Rex down the coal mine. And there was a cave-in. They rescued the men, but Rex couldn't be rescued. Everyone was upset about the fact that this pony, which was actually more of a child's pet, had been left entombed in this coal mine. So the town gathered together and actually rescued Rex out of the mine. He was no worse for wear. They had a parade, and they paraded Rex down the street. He actually became kind of famous, the pony that was rescued from the coal mine. There are several others. I have others about famous people that were in Vincennes. Carrie Nation came in 1901. That piece is in the book. I have a piece about there was a rabies scare in Vincennes in 1908 where a woman contracted rabies from her dog. So it was a big rabies scare where they were shooting all the dogs. There are three pieces I have in the book. The year 1926 was significant in Vincennes history because within just a course of 3 or 4 months, Vincennes had three of its biggest tragedies that still remain its biggest tragedies in its entire history. In January 1926, the big Birchfield department store on Main Street burned with several people killed. In February, the fire department was racing to a fire and the fire truck crashed and four firemen were killed. And then in April of that year, I believe April 1st, a Vincennes police officer, Simon Carey, was shot and killed on Main Street. So I included all three of those pieces in my first book. But three of the biggest tragedies in Vincennes history all took place within just a matter of months in 1926.
How did Vincennes and Knox County fare during the pandemic of 1918 and 1919?
I've written a lot about that this year. I wanted to see what happened at that time and how similar it was to today. But they had a lot of closings at that time, too. For various periods of time, schools were let out, were closed, just as they are today. People wore masks. There were quite a few deaths. I went through the Knox County death records to try to ascertain how many deaths there were of influenza at that time. I can't remember the number I came up with, but many of them were from pneumonia, and of course that was a product of having influenza. But it was really interesting. You know, funerals had to be private. And again, schools closed, libraries closed, theaters closed, very similar to what was done during this pandemic.
Well, coming up, we're going to dust off more archives and look back at some of the crimes of the past century in Knox County, the bad guys, the good guys, and even the bloodhounds who track them down. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Brian Spangle, author of the newly published collection of his columns from the Vincennes Sun Commercial titled Hidden History of Vincennes and Knox County. Now, fact is often stranger than fiction, as we all know. So is the case of Rosa Gillenwater, a lady who died, her body embalmed, but she was not immediately buried, and she was actually carried around in a basket for a while. Tell us about that, Brian.
Yeah, this is the most unusual story in the book. If there's ever a story that fit hidden history, this is one of them. This would be almost a Ripley's Believe It or Not story. On February 3rd, 1920, a woman named Rosa Gillenwaters died at the age of 36 in Wichita, Kansas. Her body was embalmed, as you mentioned. Her husband was attempting to transport it back to South Bend for interment. Her husband, well, they were both entertainers. They traveled from town to town doing musical acts. So he passed through several communities with his wife's remains. He was in a basket. He was finally required to get a casket. He arrived in Vincennes by train on August 5th, 1920, 8 months after she died. He was allowed to keep the body at Gardner's Funeral Home on Main Street. He claimed that he didn't have the money to take it any farther. So Gardner's let him keep the body there. He was to pay 50 cents a week for that privilege. Oddly enough, and just to show you how different things were at that time, out of morbid curiosity, people went to the funeral home just to see the body. So he left town with his stepdaughters and ended up in Leavenworth Penitentiary, if you can imagine. It seemed that he violated the Mann Act, which made it illegal to transport women across state lines for immoral purposes. Again, he was traveling with his stepdaughters. The weeks turned into months, the months turned into years, and her body remained in Vincennes. Finally, the funeral home, you know, they realized something had to be done. So it was 10 years later in 1930 that they finally made contact with him. He was in a mental hospital in Washington, D.C. They corresponded with him by letter, and he wrote back that he wanted, I think the exact quote is, his wife to be buried on dry and high ground. So the funeral home had to get permission from the State Board of Health to inter the body, and they did. That's why Rosa Gillenwaters, who has no connection to Vincennes whatsoever, is buried in Fairview Cemetery. And I found her stone, and I included a picture of her stone in the book. And it does say, you know, died Wichita, Kansas, and buried 10 years later. So anyone who just walked up and looked at that stone would never know the story. But I uncovered it from the newspaper and from some funeral home records.
Now, was her death suspicious?
I don't think it was suspicious. I don't think it gave the cause of death.
Mm-hmm.
But she was just 36 years old.
That's
so
you wonder.
It could have been.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There's might be another story there somewhere.
That might be.
Now, you talk about a crime wave in the Knox County communities of Sanborn and Oaktown, and safes were blown at the local post offices, the office of the Knox County Treasurer robbed. Mm-hmm. So folks were desperate to get these bad guys, and they brought bloodhounds into town. Tell us about that. It was like 1907.
That was in 1907. Vincennes didn't have bloodhounds. There had been quite a bit of crime. Whenever they needed bloodhounds, they had to bring them in from another community. So the sheriff and the police commissioner and the bailiff went together and purchased a pair of bloodhounds from San Antonio, Texas, $250 in 1907, which is the equivalent of $7,000 in today's money. So bloodhounds were a costly have in your community. Had them for tracking, kept them at the jail. They were named Red and Lizzie. People were really proud of them. One of the funniest quotes I found was the town of Linville is where they had gotten bloodhounds before, and they boasted that they were more competent looking than the Linville hounds. And most people had never seen bloodhounds, and they were just so taken by their long floppy ears. And so they were used in cases. In May, a little restaurant in Bruceville was burglarized, and the hounds were taken there, and they tracked it to the train depot, and so they found out, you know, that where they purchased a ticket for, and so they were very useful. Sometimes they ran a cold trail, but they were very useful.
But they were very proud of these bloodhounds.
Extremely proud
there
of
you
the
go,
bloodhounds.
That's right. Now, there was the cornstalk killing, and I thought this was really gruesome.
Very gruesome. That was a murder that took place in Vincennes in 1919. A 75-year-old woman named Anna Linebach, a widow, was walking home after dark from her son's home, and she disappeared. She didn't arrive at her destination. Her family didn't know what happened to her, so the police were called, and her body was found by the Dunbar School, which was the school for African-American children in Vincennes. There was sort of a garden to the back with corn growing, and her body was found there. She'd been strangled, and she had been, corn stalks were used to,
mutilate?
Yeah, to mutilate the body, and the killer had done that to throw the police off. So they undertook detective work, and what I found really interesting was in the days after the murder, people came to the site and just tromped around and looked it over, and I guess there was no such thing as keeping a crime scene free and clear at that time. But they did a lot of detective work, found that the murderer was a man named William Shooter. He was 39, had been drunk at the time. He was taken to the Knox County Jail. He eventually confessed. He said he didn't really give any reason for the murder other than he was drunk, and he said that any woman he had come across at that time would have met the same fate. Entered a guilty plea and was taken to the Indiana State Prison in Michigan City, given a life sentence. And then I actually found when he was finally paroled. People in Vincennes didn't want him to have a parole because even years later, it was not forgotten what he had done. But in 1954, all those years later, he was 74 years old and he was paroled. Said he had a good prison record and he'd become a skilled locksmith. So he lived at the home of his daughter in Vincennes.
So he came back to the community.
Came back to Vincennes and lived with one of his daughters, and he died in 1958, and he's actually buried in the same cemetery as his victim from all those years ago.
Now, there was a devastating hailstorm that hit some communities in Knox County, and when was that, Brian?
That was in 1907. I actually have that story in this book and another story about a hailstorm in my first book that hit Vincennes. The piece I have in this book is 1907, a hailstorm that hit the northern part of the county in summer of 1907. Destroyed the corn crop. Hailstones just ripped up the corn crop, killed chickens and birds, it said.
You said the hailstones were the size of eggs?
Some of them were the size of hen's eggs. There was a passenger train near Edwardsport that had to stop because there was so much hail on the tracks, and the people were huddled in the center aisle. The hailstones were smashing through the windows and pummeling the train, and broken glass was everywhere. But it only lasted about 15 minutes. They didn't have any hail in Vincennes that time, but a devastating hailstorm. Mm-hmm. So I like to write about weather, too.
Oh,
yeah. A lot of interesting weather events.
Now, you've got some other interesting people in here. A Civil War nurse named Nancy Gardner Baker from Vincennes, and she was responded to a train wreck.
Yeah, that's another interesting story that I just came across as I was perusing the newspapers on December 31st, 1930. The front page of the Vincennes commercial had a headline that said, woman who served as nurse in Civil War time is dead. So I knew I had to research that.
Sure.
And that was Nancy Gardner, later Nancy Gardner Baker. But in 1862, a Civil War troop train on the Ohio-Mississippi Railroad carrying members of the 98th Illinois Infantry had a horrific accident near Bridgeport, Illinois. A switch was left open and caused the train to veer off the track and crash into a freight train. 8 men were killed, 75 injured. There was no hospital, local hospital to take people to at that time. Doctors came to assist with the tragedy, but a temporary hospital was set up in Vincennes, and 3 local women, Nancy Gardner being one of them, just 21 years old, no nurses training, nursed the men, and that was remembered all those years later that she mm-hmm. had done that work. And several of her family members ended up being in the Spanish-American War. She had family members in the Civil War as well. And even during World War I, she was always committed to helping servicemen. And during the First World War, one of the big activities for women on the home front was to knit socks and other garments for the men in the trenches in Europe. And she undertook that work. She was always honored on Decoration Day. The other two ladies had died much earlier, one in the 1880s and one in the 1890s. So on Decoration Day, now Memorial Day, they took flowers to the graves, and then they always presented her with a big bouquet of flowers at her home. So her death was just short of the age of 90 when mm-hmm. she died that year.
Another lady that honored and in your columns, Ruth Gordon.
Jordan.
Jordan. Yep, oh, Jordan. Okay.
Yep. She has an interesting story as well. I think her individual story is part of a larger story in that she was the only nurse who graduated from Good Samaritan Hospital who actually went overseas during the First World War. There were others from Knox County who were Red Cross nurses, but she was a member of the Army Nurse Corps. Graduated from Good Samaritan Hospital, went to England and France and nursed the men there. She wrote letters back that the paper published that told what was happening. She has I put some really good quotes in that particular column. Came back, and there's a great photo of her with her uniform on that's in the book. came back and continued her nursing, never married, and worked as a nurse for the rest of her life. But another part of that story is what happened in 1920 then, what women got the right to vote. People talk about the Second World War getting women out of the house and into the factories, but the First World War contributed to that too, and expanding women's rights to a certain extent. So people like Ruth Jordan fall into that category.
Are you still cranking out these columns, Brian?
I'm still cranking them out. I've written the column since 1999. I've written over 1,100 columns now. There are 149 in my first book and 70-some in this book. And people always ask me, well, when's the third book going to come out? I said, well, it's already written. You know, I've got enough columns for multiple books. And I've written on a lot of interesting topics. But, yeah, I still write the column every week.
Do people give you ideas?
Oh, yeah, they do. Actually, my column is on 20th century. It's interesting how that came about. In 1999, of course, everybody was thinking about the new century about to start. And the managing editor of the Sun commercial at that time asked me if I would write a column about 20th century history. He thought it would be good to look back at the 20th century. That's how the column started. So most of my columns are about 20th century. And I've started going back a little bit in the 19th century because there's so many interesting things happen there too, but people will give me all kinds of ideas. Sometimes I can use them and sometimes not.
Brian Spangle, thanks for sharing these stories in your book, Vincennes: Hidden History of Vincennes in Knox County. Now, this is from Arcadia Publishing and the History Press. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, like you said, there are more stories to share with readers at the Vincennes Sun Commercial. And you continue to remind us of the importance of knowing and understanding our past, the good, the bad, and, of course, the bizarre, which is always interesting. Brian Spangle, thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I love to talk about history, and research is my favorite thing to do.
Well, keep digging. I know you will. All right. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management. A footnote to my interview with Brian Spangle. I reached out to Eric Beck at Mesker Park Zoo to see if there was any record of Bruno the bear. Well, Eric checked his animal records with no luck, but he did tell me that's not unusual because this happened so long ago.